Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, March 9th, 2025, is by the Reverend Barbara Threat on the topic of those words.
I stand here this morning as your part-time minister of this Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington. It is my honor and privilege to serve as the minister of this fellowship. As most of you know, I'm also the part-time minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Rutland and the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Glens Falls. I've been a UU for nearly 50 years since I started to attend the Unitarian Universalist Society of Oneonta, New York. Before I started seminary, I was a member of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. You'll have to guess where, it's not in their name. And I did my internship with the Unitarian Universalists of San Mateo. From their name, it's clear where they are, but it's unclear who they are or why they gather, unless you happen to recognize the term Unitarian Universalist. I have heard most of those names mocked or objected to by one person or another. Fellowship sounds like something out of Lord of the Rings. Society reminds one of the Humane Society. Church is way too Christian. And a congregation is a group of plovers or puffins or sometimes eagles. When I first said, I chuckled and thought how very UU it is to know that bit of obscure information. And most of us affectionately refer to this space as our meeting house, a term which I quite like. But it's also what the gathering place for Quakers is usually called, and we are Unitarian Universalists and not Quakers. Words and names. They matter a lot, especially to UUs, I think, and they are complicated. A few days ago, I consulted with the chairs of our UU Fellowship of Bennington Sunday Service Committee. Next Thursday, I'll meet with the Worship Committee at Glens Falls, and 2 days ago, I met with the Sunday ours is the Sunday Services Committee. Next Thursday, I'll meet with the Worship Committee in Glens Falls, and 2 days ago, I met with the Sunday Service Emphatically Singular Committee in Rutland. They all serve the same function in their respective places. Each committee is called differently, and a few people in every one of those places can explain why their designation is the most appropriate. All of which is to say, we really do care a lot about what words we use. Sometimes that's a blessing, and sometimes I would suggest not so much. Words are tricky. I listened with much interest to the recorded service from a few weeks ago when several of you explored what various words mean to you and why they're troublesome. I've heard those conversations for decades as a UU. Words like God and church, worship and prayer and sacred. Even words like forgiveness or salvation or grace. Those are loaded words, every one of them. They contain centuries of meanings, centuries of bringing comfort to some and doing great harm to others, centuries of defining who's included and who's not, centuries of history and domination and revolution and change. They are difficult words without a question. I don't have any answers, although I do have opinions. And today I want to share some of my reflections about those words and explain some of my own decisions about my use of a few of them, most problematic. And rather like that renegade Harry Potter, I'm going to skip the he who must not be named approach and use the words themselves, church and especially God. I'll go back to that day of walking into the UU Society of Oneonta for the first time. Actually, I'll go a little further back. I was raised fundamentalist Baptist, as most of you know, evangelical Baptist. The Bible, the King James Bible, to be specific, was not only literally true, but it was directed by God, specifically to men, to write down. Heaven and hell were real. Jesus was the only path to salvation and all the rest. Our family went to church twice every Sunday, and at least one or two other times every week. That form of Christianity was at the center of our lives. I began doubting a lot of what I was taught before I'd even reached my teens. I was a problem. My family switched to another fundamentalist church when I was 15. My sister and I hated that church. So when I got my license at 16, we persuaded my dad that we should be able to drive to our old church, and he agreed. But I had had it with church. I just dropped my sister off and then drove around for a few hours or sat and read a book. My dad noticed the gas was going down fairly quickly and suggested I put some gas in, but he didn't say anything more. I swore I would never go to a church again. And except for the weddings of my two siblings, I didn't until my late 20s. So when I walked into that UU church in Oneonta, beautiful brick building with stained glass windows and a steeple, it was with much trepidation. It was only because a neighbor had been bugging me for months to go to her church. And I went so she would stop asking. I had no intention of getting involved in a church. And I will say that if anyone in that service had emphasized God, or gone on about Jesus, or sung a hymn that I recognized, I probably would have walked out. I felt that damaged by that theology. Instead, they started the service with "Morning Has Broken." Cat Stevens, I thought, in church? They called their building the Society rather than a church. Early in the service, they recited, "Love is the doctrine of this church," in unison, and I was stunned. The quest for truth? Seeking knowledge and freedom? It was all new, and it was very much not what I had grown up, what I had rejected. While those words did end with God, that service was so different from what I'd ever heard that I could ignore that word. And the absence of all those Baptist trappings, including those words, is a large part of what allowed me to stay. I loved that I could find a new language for worship and ignore the words that had caused so much pain. About the same time I started attending that church, I was hired by Planned Parenthood as an outreach worker, going into little rural towns and places miles outside of little rural towns in central upstate New York and knocking on doors to tell them about Planned Parenthood. I had spent most of my 20s heavily involved in women's health as a childbirth educator, LaLeche League leader, supporting breastfeeding mothers, and then designing and leading women's health classes to groups of educated women who were embracing the feminist movement of the 1970s. I had gotten very comfortable with the language of women's health. Uteruses and contraception, menstruation, fimbria, zygotes, contractions, all kinds of those things. I knew the language well. I knew the terminology, and I could explain things clearly. Planned Parenthood was elated to hire me. What I quickly discovered is that for all that learning, I didn't speak the language of the people I needed to reach. My typical client was a female in her 20s who quite likely had dropped out of high school because she was pregnant. She probably already had a couple of children. She probably referred to herself as a girl, and almost certainly not as a woman. Those children, they had developed in her womb. She'd heard about the pill, but she probably looked puzzled if I mentioned oral contraception. And if I asked what her age was at menarche, I might as well have been speaking Latin. In her language, she had started periods. In order to communicate with that woman, I needed to learn her language. I quickly learned that in order to take a useful medical history, I needed to ask questions with words that she knew. Words that made her feel respected and not belittled. As I gained trust, I could mention that a doctor might use medical jargon like uterus, but no way would it have been effective if I had informed her that uterus was the correct or medical word for her womb. I knew the technical language, but I needed to speak with the words that the other person knew and recognized. Otherwise, all my careful learning and politically and medically correct terminology was useless. I think about that experience a lot when I consider those problematic religious words, God and church, prayer and salvation and worship and so many more. They are loaded, every one of them. They have been used to do great harm in our world and to many of us personally. Many of them imply allegiance to a specific theology. Church is unquestionably the term for a house of worship in the Christian tradition, and it has been for upwards of 2,000 years. And that word, God. God, I was taught, was, first of all, emphatically male. He was God the Father. And he was an angry God, angry and heartbroken at the sinful nature of us humans, which he supposedly created, which was the root of some of my early theological wonderings. How could a perfect God create such imperfect and loathsome beings anyway? What sort of wise God was he? But back to God. I was taught that he watched every move that we made to see where we followed his will and where we failed, and most of the time we failed. He lived somewhere up in the heavens. He had a white beard and flowing robes and flashing angry eyes, and he was immense, judgmental, and terrifying. To my mind, that image of God and all the baggage it carries with it are well worth challenging and resisting and rejecting. And still, billions of people all around our world regularly gather in groups like this. Millions and millions of such gatherings are happening this morning. To honor a deity, perhaps? To affirm our connections to one another? To nourish our souls or strengthen our resolve to live more ethical lives? Maybe to combat the forces of evil? The reasons why we gather in such settings are many, but the act of gathering this morning, as we are this morning, is nearly universal. I've been reading a lot about Theodore Parker recently, including wading through his writings. He's a Unitarian minister and Transcendentalist who lived from 1810 to 1860. In 1841, he delivered a sermon that is still considered one of the most important and was one of the most controversial in UU history. He suggested that the urge towards some connection with whatever is beyond ourselves was so strong and so universal that Jesus and all the rituals of the church and even the Bible of itself were not essential at all, although they were helpful. Parker believed that that urge toward the sacred exists in each of us, and that it can lead us to the holy without any of those trappings. He defined it as an urge toward the heart of Christianity, which was his framework. And of course, that sermon provoked all kinds of outrage. I agree with him, although I would take that urge far beyond Christianity. But I do believe that each of us has a pull toward, and here words fail, the peace of nature, the majesty of a great cathedral, the centeredness of a Buddhist meditation, the comfort that many Christians feel in their confidence in the love of Jesus, the silence of a sunset, the power of community, the beauty of a symphony, or the indescribable amazement of holding your child for the first time. There are things which are almost indescribable, and the only word I know is they're of such worth that it becomes worshipful. There is an impulse in each of us, I believe, with Parker, towards some force or reality that is beyond and greater than our individual selves, toward wonder and awe and inspiration, something way beyond any name or number or any other easy representation. An impulse, if you will, toward worship, although that's not a word that I'm going to explore this morning. For me, that sacred namelessness is the deep and unbreakable connectivity between everything. It's the interdependent web. A song in our hymnal called A Fire Mist and a Planet goes, a fire mist and a planet, a crystal and a cell, a starfish and a saurian, and caves where ancients dwell. The sense of law and beauty, a face to turn from the sod, some call it evolution, and others call it God. Haze on the far horizon, the infinite tender sky, the ripe rich tints of cornfields and wild geese sailing high, and over high and lowland the charm of goldenrod. Some people call it autumn, and others call it God. Like tides on crescent sea beach, when moons so new and thin, into our hearts high yearnings comes welling, surging in, comes from the mystic ocean whose rim no foot has trod. Some people call it longing, and others call it God. A sentry lone and frozen, a mother starved for her brood, and Socrates dared hemlock and Jesus on the rood, and millions who, though nameless, the straight, hard pathway trod. Some call it consecration, and others call it God. UU Minister Forrest Church wrote, "The power which I cannot explain or know or name, I choose to call God. God is not God's name. God is my name, my shorthand for the mystery that looms within and arches beyond the limits of my being. Life force, spirit of life, ground of all being, these two are names for the unnameable, which I am now content to call God." And that has become true for me over the years. God is the only word for me that feels big enough and open enough, and it's my shorthand for something radically different from the God of my childhood. Another story. When I was in seminary in Star King, I took many classes at other schools that were part of the Graduate Theological Union. One of them was a class at the UCC, United Church of Christ Seminary, which was pretty liberal. UCC and UU's almost combined at various points. The first day of class, we went around the table with introductions. A few UCC students, some Catholics, a Presbyterian, a Methodist or two, a Coptic Christian from Cameroon, if I remember correctly. We were quite a mix. The man sitting next to me was unusually dressed up for seminary classes. He was wearing a tie and a sports jacket. He introduced himself by explaining that he was on sabbatical from his position as a professor in a very conservative Baptist college, which would quite likely fire him if they knew he was attending a class at such a place as this. We welcomed him, of course, and then I introduced myself as the lone Unitarian Universalist. He quite literally moved his chair away from me. He was visibly upset to be near such a heretic, I suppose. And he pointedly avoided any interactions with me that day. At the end of that first class, the professor handed out a detailed syllabus. She had clearly printed it days before. And it included the pairings that she had made for a semester-long project. And you guessed it, she had paired me with this very conservative fundamentalist Baptist. It was actually a great semester. He and I wound up having many rich conversations, which often spilled over into class. It was clear that many of his beliefs were shifting and shifting more because of this class, and they probably had been for some time. We didn't stay in touch, and I've often wondered what happened to him. I suspect that he found that he could not go back to his old position. But what I know is that in one of our last conversations, he looked at me almost fiercely and said, "There was a time when people like you were challenging people like me and transforming religion, and it worked. Your people and their arguments were tremendously powerful and persuasive. And then you liberals got lazy and you backed off and you left defining religion to people like me." I think about his comments a lot, especially now. I watch the rise of evangelical Christianity and what I perceive as being efforts to make that way of seeing the world, including their understanding of God, to make that the dominant religion. I watch the moves toward public funding of religiously based schools, toward legislating that the Bible must be taught in public schools. God, in that view of the world, is deeply offended by same-sex marriage and is horrified by trans people. God, that God, created men and women here, period. Religiously based violence is increasing. Respect for people who call their deity Allah or any other such name is disappearing, and the list goes on. There are loud voices claiming that God is on the side of those forces. We have been told that God spared this life or enabled the passage of that law because God sports an agenda, which I find abhorrent. In this country, the people who claim and preach that perception of God are controlling the public definition of what God is. And in our country, the great majority of people do believe in God. I place a great deal of value on the UU love for words. I am very fond of our being a fellowship, for example. To me, that word denotes community and warmth, acceptance, and mutual support. I would go so far as to say that Of all the words that describe you, your groupings, and I hope that nobody from other my churches is listening to this later on, I like fellowship the best. Congregation does sound rather clinical and cold. Church, without question, is very Christian. And society feels like a social gathering. I like fellowship a lot. But when I'm speaking to anyone outside of our UU fellowship, I call us a church. I may mention that we call ourselves a fellowship, but I always use the word church. It's the word that the larger world recognizes and understands. I want that word church, widely understood to be a home of some sort of religious group, to include this kind of group, and our kind of religion, even though I know some of us don't like the word religion. I want the power of that word church to include Unitarian Universalism, as well as those groups whose values fly in the face of most everything that we believe. And if I don't use that word, I'm leaving the defining of that word to people who do support things I find abhorrent. It is without question a Christian word, and I realize that. It has caused great pain to many, including me. But it's also a word with great influence for an institution that has brought comfort and courage to many, and it's a word our culture recognizes. If I say I'm part of a fellowship, that doesn't mean anything. Part of a church, they know something of what that means. I feel the same about a lot of other words. I want to be part of broadening these words, which still have such tremendous power in our society. My friend in seminary was right. A large part of the move to see Jesus as a man with valuable teachings, rather than just some divine means of salvation, is because of the voices of our religious ancestors. The move to claim religious value in nature, or to affirm and explore the spirituality of Buddhism, or to make space for women as religious leaders, those are the gifts of our UU ancestors who spoke out, who pushed to expand the definition of what was sacred, who affirmed that there are many valid ways to worship, and who insisted that women as well as men could be religious leaders. I want for us UUs to continue to do that expansive work. And to do that, we need to be able and willing to speak the language of those outside of our walls. Within our walls, yes, by all means, we need to find words that have meaning to us. And we need to do that with the awareness that in our own congregation, I can name people who identify as Christian and pagan and atheist and Buddhist and those who are completely uninterested in any of those labels. So whatever words we choose need to include all of those, and that's difficult. But we need somehow to stay in the larger congregation or conversation. If we pretend that words like God or worship don't matter at all, then we are leaving the defining of those words, which matter so much to so many people. We are leaving the defining to those who will define them in ways that deny a great deal of what we value. UUs have struggled with these words for a very long time. Our hymnal still contains many songs with God language. As I went through, I was surprised, frankly, at how many there were in some sections. But even those have changed. We now sing, "Holy, holy, holy, author of creation," instead of, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty." One of the goals of creating our current hymnal over 30 years ago was to remove definitions of God as being always He, as well as changing man and mankind to people or humankind. We do wrestle with what to call our buildings and what to name the groups that meet within them. And I know there are efforts underway to look at the words we use within our own UU fellowship, efforts which I applaud and will do my best to support. Changing words is not easy. Witness the recent upheaval caused by updating the seven principles to the newer values. But in all of this conversation, I would urge us to think carefully about how we can stay in the conversation, which defines what those powerful words mean, even words we don't like or find offensive, rather than tossing them out and ceding those words with such power to those who would define them in ways that are directly opposed to what we believe. I would urge us to remember that there is a wide range of theological and religious diversity right here within our own congregation, and that we have different responses to different words. And I would urge us to remember that while we, like most every group of humans, will inevitably have some of our own insider language and terminology, we also need to keep enough of the common language so that outsiders, both those who might find us and love us, and those who believe that we are an anathema, can understand what we're talking about and that we're part of the conversation, that we can bring our values to those words. I would risk a bit of religious language now, although it's one that's become less controversial. I would offer us blessings on our words and our work, on our minds and our hearts, and on our journey. Amen.